Here we are.
Welcome to class number four. I'm pretty sure, because it says class four over here. Okay, and today we're going to talk about a prenuptial agreement. This is something that you might have heard about, but it's very worthwhile to understand what it's really all about, why we have a prenuptial agreement, and where it comes from. Okay, what is a prenuptial agreement? I would tend to bet that the vast majority of you, actually all of you, did not sign a prenuptial agreement. Right? What am I talking about? I am not talking about a Ronald Lauder or what's the name of that guy? The guy in England whose wife is divorcing him for $1.4 billion. Paul McCartney prenuptial agreement. Now, we're not talking about that type of prenuptial agreement. We're talking about a Jewish Orthodox prenuptial agreement. We're going to talk about why do we need prenuptial agreements and how it started, what the problems were, what the issues are, and how we've resolved them. And then we're also going to talk about what the challenges are and why people don't do them, et cetera, et cetera. This is actually a very, very, very fascinating and important issue for people to be aware of. First and foremost, the Torah says the following. Source number one, okay? Ki yikach ish isha uba'ala. If a man shall take a woman and he lives with her, okay, marrieth her. Hayayim lo timsa chen deinav, if she does not find favor in his eyes. Ki matsa ba'ervat davar, he has found a ervat davar, found some unseemly thing in her. That's a very vague language. It's an argument about what it really means. V'katav la sefer kritut, he writes for her a bill of divorces. V'natan v'yada, and he gives it in her hand, v'shilcha mibeito, and he sends her out of his house. This is the pasuk that is the source for the entirety of Meseches Gittin. Right? The whole Meseches of Gittin, much of it is about the law of get. Get is extremely, extremely complicated. It's very, very, very easy to get married. It's much, much, much harder to get divorced properly. It has to be written with certain parameters, as we're going to see. It has to be written extremely carefully. It has to be written in the right, with the right date, in the right time, in the right name, by a scribe. It has to be given over to her. It's very, very difficult. How do you get married?
He says, you're my wife.
With a french fry. As I've said before, right? Like I said,
break the glass.
Right? No, you don't break the glass, right? There's no community property in Judaic law, actually. What belongs to her belongs to him, but belongs to her belongs to her. She, you know, but really, community property means it belongs to him, and then she can take back whatever she brought with her into the marriage. So now, what are you talking about, Rabbi? We talked about sexuality, we talked about shidduchim, one sexuality, two class on shidduchim, class number four, right? What are you talking about getting divorced already for? Let's get married first, you know, let's enjoy a wedding. Chas v'shalom, you should have to talk about divorces. Why do we have to get into prenuptial agreements?
Because it's a problem.
The answer is, it's a problem. The Torah, the way the pasuk is framed, and this is the halakha, there's no, I'm uncomfortable talking about why or how. There's no if, ands, or buts about it. Who has the power in the relationship?
The man
has the power. In this, I mean, the woman has a lot of power. It drives me. That's not an issue, but in this area, in the area of divorce, the power belongs to the man. It says in the Torah, the nasan biyada, he gives to her. So the bottom line is, if he gives her the bill of divorce, they are divorced. If he does not give her the bill of divorce, they are not divorced. What if he's a jerk? What if he's a low-down, good-for-nothing, pain in the behind, and he says, I'm not giving you divorce till you pay me every single cent you owe? She's stuck. Right? Normally, we hope that he doesn't act like a jerk. But because he has the power to act like a jerk,
he does.
You can't, you know, you just understand, and sometimes I say this to young women. You say to them, you can't be cavalier about this. You better know who you're marrying, because when you accept that ring and become married to this man, you are giving up your life. You are giving him a tremendous amount of power over you. So understand that when you go into the relationship. If it's a relationship of love and caring, you have trust in this person, great. But if you're not sure, don't do it. Because you have to understand the ramifications of what you're giving up.
What if she refuses to take it?
Ah, she has to take it too. Right.
She has to take it.
Well, not really. We'll say against her will, she could be coerced to take it.
To receive it.
Now we come to the crux of the issue. I just like to highlight. The system, people say, and now this obviously leads to cases, and I must say it's fewer cases than people talk about. Oh, it's such a terrible problem, it's such a big problem. I want to say clearly, one case of, this is called an aguna. An aguna is a chained woman. Chained woman in classical literature had nothing to do with this situation. What was the classic chained woman, an aguna?
Man goes off to war.
Right.
No one knows what happens to him.
Correct. We have a case, and a terrible case. When we know a case of this in Toronto, there's a father and a son this summer. They went out fishing. They went out on a boat. The boat came back. There was a storm. The boat came back. You hear about this? This is Rabbi Hirsch's, Mrs. Hirsch's stepson.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Her son-in-law, I don't remember. Boat came back. The father's body was found. The son's body was never recovered. Not yet, at least. So this woman is the classic case of aguna, because he's missing. Nobody knows. Did he die? Didn't he die? Is there foul play? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. So she is aguna. She's aguna. She is chained to her husband, in a sense, until it can be proved definitively what happened to him. And the problem, unfortunately, it's a very frightening thought. So that was the classic case of aguna in the poskim. Especially understand, nowadays we live in a world of unbelievable telecommunications and instant contact and internet. And DNA especially. Right, we had the World Trade Center, we had cases like that of DNA matching. But it's also harder to get lost. It's harder to disappear. Whereas in olden times, husband didn't like his wife, he wasn't happy with his life, things are going bad, he skips town, you never see him again.
After 7 years, it still applies?
Yeah, it doesn't end.
7 years
only for insurance, civil, right. But not for halakha. In halakha, you're married until you are not married. There's no way to really get out of it. And there was, I think, a case of this also, I think, in our community. Right, there was a man who was killed. Right, Mr. Vitalo lives there across the
road.
Yeah, but he was found. He was found.
Yeah,
but it's not so clear that ever happens. That's the frightening thing. So, but what is the case of aguna that we deal with today? So we see here and there, there's a case where a man is lost at sea, or, God forbid, in a forest, or who knows. But nowadays, the cases that occur are women that are chained to men who are jerks. They are withholding a get for
spite,
money, parental control, you know, custody of the children. A lot of different things, which are terrible and should never, never happen. But what I say is, it is a problem of an abuse of the system. This is the system that the Torah creates. This is a halakhic system with which we have to operate. So the evil is not in the system. There's a bias towards the man who has the power, but the evil is in the man who uses that and abuses the power that he's given.
Doesn't change the situation for the wife.
Correct. Does not change the situation. But I don't think people sometimes, the solutions that a lot of people try to propose, well, we have to change the system. You know, what did reform do? Reform did something very simple. Nobody knows? Change the halakha. The woman can give a divorce. Right? Because it's an inequitable system. Let the woman give a divorce. Okay. You know, I understand reform. They don't really believe in the Torah being divine. So they can change it. But if you believe that this is God's rule, God's law, that the man brought the woman into his home and he has to give her the divorce in order to end it, so that is the system with which we are dealing. And it is possible to abuse the system. Just like it is possible to abuse any system. You know, you can abuse the civil law system to your advantage. Happens all the time. If you have more money, you can sue somebody to pieces, and there's nothing they can do about it except capitulate. That's just the way it is. So now, being that the system was available for abuse, and we have this issue of Agunot today. What can we do to prevent this from happening? What can we do to prevent a man from using the power that he has over his wife, especially in a strange situation? I mean, unfortunately, we all are familiar with situations of divorce. If it's not personal, some of us it is, some of us it's not. We know it's bitter. You know, it's very rare for two people to get divorced and say, we're the best of friends, it just didn't work out. You know, I love him, I love her, but we're separating, and it's all amicable, and everybody's happy. That's pretty rare. That's very, very rare. Usually the situation is one of some animosity, at say the very least. And I would say even more so in Orthodox situations, where people, at least divorce lawyers tell me, people wait way too long to get divorced because of community stigma. And then it's just out of control. Just totally out of control. So now you have this firecracker situation where the husband's mad at the wife's mad at the husband, they're ready to, you know, to go after each other, and then the husband realizes, I've got the upper hand, I've got the power. That is not a good situation. So what could the rabbis do to help? So let's read from source number 2, the modern day Aguna. By the way, there's a lot of great material on the internet about this. There's an institution, an organization called the Orthodox Caucus. Still exists today, I think. Orthodox Caucus is a group of mainly modern Orthodox rabbis that get together and talk about stuff. It's a caucus. Anybody know what a caucus is?
Yeah, it's a
political caucus. Right, caucus. They get together and schmooze about things. So they have this group called the Orthodox Caucus where they get together every now and then and they talk about things. So one time they talked about, and they put a book out each time. One time they put a book out about this issue of the prenuptial agreement. So there's a whole website about it, very fascinating stuff. So Rabbi Abraham Weiss, Abbi Weiss, wrote the following. He says, unilateral right of the husband was limited by the advent of the ketubah. To divorce his wife was limited by the advent of ketubah, which details the many obligations that a husband has to his wife, including an amount of money that his wife would receive in case of divorce. That you should just know, the rabbis were light years ahead of their time when it came to women's rights. Right? The ketubah, the Rabbanan said, Isha b'lo ketubah is asura labala. You're not allowed to marry a woman without giving her a ketubah. What is a ketubah? We're going to see in a few weeks. What's a ketubah?
Contract.
It's a contract. What does it say in the contract?
Right. The obligations of the husband.
It's just money. That's all it is. Right. However much it is, but I'll get to this in a few weeks. People write up on the beautiful ketubah and they have the flowery whatever, you know. If you drew up a financial prenuptial contract, that delineates the allocation of assets in the case of divorce or death, would you frame it in beautiful language? And
no, that's why
I'm just in the drawer. Right, mine is a mistake to buy the best, because it's not. That's exactly what I'm saying. No, you're not. But okay, anyway. In this way, a husband would say, so when the ketubah came about, so you could just divorce her. Why wouldn't you divorce your wife? It's going to cost you money. That's a good deterrent. Is it worth it? Nah, we'll work it out. Okay. In this way, a husband's absolute power to divorce his wife was severely restricted. This financial obligation would make him think twice before indiscriminately giving a get to his wife. Thus, the ketubah served as a deterrent to the unilateral divorce. The unilateral power of the husband to give the get disappeared in its entirety 1,000 years ago when Rav Gershom declared that a get could not be given without his wife's consent. Meaning, it used to be, min ha-Torah, according to the Torah, you could force her to take it. But now, Rav Gershom said, no, you can't force her to take it. If the ketubah made it difficult for a husband to unilaterally divorce his wife, Rav Gershom obviated that unilateral power in its entirety. The get became a bilateral process rather than a unilateral one. I don't know if I agree with that entirely. It's not bilateral. It's not, you know, it's much easier to coerce her to receive than it is to coerce him to give. With time, the get process entered yet a different stage, a stage in which women could initiate a get. In the Middle Ages, for example, central Jewish communities in Europe were governed by the Vad Arba Arzot, the committee of the four major Jewish population centers. Jews there had their own political sovereignty and judicial autonomy. Aviva, would you mind closing the door? Is that okay? Thus, in such a setting, the courts ruled with an iron hand and their decisions had to be followed. Given the fact that mobility was difficult and moreover the relationship between these respective Jewish communities was sound, few people could escape a decision not in their favor. In this situation, the woman could start the divorce proceedings by going to a Beit Din and registering complaints against her husband, By the way, in order to initiate complaints against her husband, what kind of complaints did she have to have? Could she just say, I don't like it, irreconcilable differences? No, it had to be something more than that. It had to be legitimate complaints of mistreatment or abuse or incompatibility, something serious. You know, irreconcilable differences was not considered generally a legitimate complaint, especially for the woman to initiate. If the Beijing clown found her claims reasoned enough for divorce, it was powerful enough to order the husband to give the get to his wife. You hear that, Eddie? Hmm. Beijing can order a husband to give a get to his wife. Right?
Can order him, but that doesn't mean he's going
to
do it.
While the get was still physically given by husband to wife, it was effectively taken out of the husband's exclusive domain and placed in the domain of the Beijing. As long as the Beijing was strong enough, the Abuna problem was resolved. So now we're going to see, by the way, how that works, why that's true, and what the problems are. Turn to page 2, please. Says the Mishnah. There are two Mishnayot. Okay? Now we're going to see that outline these following laws. Okay? The first one is in Yevamot, chapter 14. The Mishnah says, and we'll read it for the whole Mishnah, why not? Cheresh shenasa pikechet, upikeach shenasa cheresh. Let's say a deaf person marries a speaking woman, or a speaking person marries a deaf woman. So the point is, how can they communicate the marriage and the divorce? Im ratza yotzi v'matza yikayim, he can stay married to her and he can divorce her. K'shem zehu kones b'remiza, kachu motzi b'remiza. So how did he say, hare at mekudesh et li, you are married to me if he's deaf? The answer is, right, now remember, before hearing aids, before, how did he say it? For those at home, sorry. Okay, right? Yeah, and so the same way that he was able to signal to her and communicate the fact that they would get married, so that signaling communication, that verbal communication is sufficient for divorce.
Point to the door.
Yeah, point to the door. Right. Let's say speaking people married each other, and then she became unable to speak. If he wants, he can divorce her, and if not, he can. If not, he doesn't want to divorce her, he can maintain the marriage. Nishtatit. What happens if she loses her mind? Never heard of this happening? Lo aleinu, it's a terrible thing. How could she accept a divorce if she
is not
of sound mind? Lo yotzi. Right? He may not divorce her. Nitchareshu o nishtateh. Let's say he becomes unable to communicate. Or nishtateh, or he becomes crazy. Eina motzi olamis. He can never divorce her. It's interesting. My grandfather was a rabbi in Massachusetts, in Winter, Massachusetts, and he was very, very involved with the Vad HaRabbanim of Boston. And he told me he had a situation once. He worked in a mental institution because he was also a clinical pastoral psychologist. And he would go visit patients. There was one man who was married to his wife and he lost his mind. And so he would wander around the city, you know, and they would pick him up. They would try to get him, a Jewish man, they would try to get him to the mental hospital. But he had periods of lucidity. So my grandfather, he got a ruling from a rabbi, I don't remember who the rabbi was, maybe Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't remember, who ruled that if he was a period of lucidity, if you could evaluate his lucidity, he would be capable of giving his wife a divorce during that time. And so they convened the Beit Din. He brought the rabbinical court to the mental institution so that this person could issue his wife a divorce, probably on medication, and that she wouldn't be chained to her husband, you know, in an unlimited way. So you always see rabbis bending over backwards to try to make sure that women are not in this untenable situation. Amar Rav Yochanan ben Guri. Says Rav Yochanan ben Guri. Idema ha'isha nitcharsha yotza. How can you divorce? Why is it you can divorce a woman who became deaf? Va'isha nitcharesh eino mozi, but the deaf man cannot divorce. I'm on page 2. Amrulo, so they said, eino dome ha'isha megaresh le'isha mitgareshet. A man who gives divorce is not like a woman who is divorced. Sha'isha yotza l'rtona v'shalo l'rtona. For a woman may be divorced with her consent as well as without it. V'ha'ish eina motzi ela l'rtona. And a man can give a divorce only with his full consent. Meaning, according to Torah law, now Rabbi Gershom, remember, we said, nullified that later on. But according to Torah law, a man can divorce a woman whether she likes it or not. Where he cannot give his divorce unless he has dot, unless he can demonstrate lucidity. So if he lost his mind or he can no longer communicate, there's no way for us to demonstrate that lucidity, and therefore the divorce is not valid. So therefore, we see one situation where the man has all the power and the woman does not. Okay?
Yes, a little way. Besides the imbecile, is that the nice way to put it?
Technical language. Don't worry about it. You know what I'm saying? It's not, the Mishnah doesn't mean anything by it. That's the technical way of describing a person who has lost their sanity. Okay? Mishnah, next Mishnah. Okay? Let's skip down. Skip down three lines from the bottom. See what says get me'usa? Now, this is a term that we're going to discuss. Get me'usa. A get me'usa, you see, is a get given under compulsion. How do you give a get under compulsion? So this just says, Yisrael kosher. If a Jewish court forces you to give a get, it's kosher. Ubegoyim pasul. But if a non-Jewish court coerces you to give the get, it's not a good get. Ubagoyim But if a non-Jew is going to say, come to you and say, come to the husband and say, you better do what the Jewish court tells you to do, then that's okay. This is the root of the challenge of coercing a husband to give a get. A Jewish court has the right to compel a husband to give a get to his wife. A non-Jewish court does not have the right to compel a husband to give a get to his wife. Why not?
They have no authority as well.
What?
They have no authority as well. It's Jewish law.
Plenty of authority. If you lived in the local manor, right? Whatever the lord of the manor said, that's what you did. You know why?
No, why?
Because otherwise you'd be dead. And nobody would care. So he had plenty of authority to say, hey, you, Mendel of Glitzburg, I don't like you. Go divorce your wife. So the Gemara says that the reason why that would not be kosher is because then a woman would then be able to hire some, you know, pay off the local hegemony and say, I want to get a divorce. And it would create an institution, it would ruin the institution of divorce. Because no divorce would be legitimate because all she could do is pay him off. Or some other guy could pay off, you know, if I like your wife, right? I just pay off the guy, the king, to make sure that you divorce your wife and finish. It would uproot the entire function of marriage, the entire institution of marriage. So therefore the rabbi said that kind of get, puzzle. But if the rabbis could force you, then it's kosher. But you have a problem. You have a fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is, how can the Beit Din coerce you to do something that you have to do according to your will? Remember what the Torah says. The Nashan La. He must give to her, meaning he must want to give to her. So what if the only reason I'm giving to her is because Beit Din is forcing me? By the way, how would Beit Din force me?
They beat the daylights out of me.
Right. Murder Incorporated. Murder Incorporated, they're Jewish, right? Murder Incorporated, they were Jewish?
Purple Gang.
Right, Purple Gang. They would hire the Purple Gang and say, I need a favor, my good friend, we're all friends, I need a favor. Right. This young man will give a divorce to my daughter, and the Beit Din, the court is in favor of it. You're allowed to do it. So how does this work? So in order to understand this, we'll look at the Rambam. Rambam is on page 3. Again, I'm giving you the chapter headings of this discussion just to understand. I think it's very important just to understand what the issues are when we talk about a prenuptial agreement. Why is there such a thing as a prenuptial agreement? And how does it work? How doesn't it work also? Says the Rambam, Hilchos Gerushin, says in the laws of divorce. And this is the very beginning of the laws of divorce. Ein ha'isha mitgareshet. Are there more? I think there's a couple more sheets. Whatever that. Ein ha'isha mitgareshet ela bichtar. A woman can only be divorced in writing. By the way, how do you get married? Verbally, right? Kesef, star, beer. You can even get married, with sexual relations or a contract or with money. Very easy to get married. Very hard to get divorced. El b'tav shi yagi ala. It has to arrive in her hands. U'kitav zehu anikra get. What is a get? A bill of divorce, right? It's a bill of divorce. That's one of the types of get. There are ten factors that are main parts of gerushin, of get. The Elohim, these are them. One, Aleph. Shelo yigaresha ish ela birtzono. It must be of his own volition. He has to want to give her the get. Two, sheyigaresh bichtav v'lo b'devar acher. He cannot send her a divorce email. You would think nowadays. Right, it's a signature, right here.
No text message.
Dear Han, see ya. Although nowadays you can see that happening.
Yes.
Okay. Dear John. The writing must say in it, I am divorcing you and you're out of my life and whatever. Dalit, the essence of the writing must be davar hakoreit beino ubeina. It is something that koreit cuts off between him and her. A get kritut is called a cutting off, a divorce. V'sheyeh nichtav bishmat. This now gets tricky. It must be written for the sake of this divorce. You tell the scribe, he has to hire the scribe and say, I want you to write this get for the purpose of divorcing, you know, my wife Mary Jane. And that's another reason why, by the way, you can't, it's a real issue, a real good question, it can't be printed out. Now, can I press print? Can I put in all the names on my word processor and press print and print it out? It has to be written. Lishma. Now, just for your knowledge, a ketubah can be written, can be printed out. I've done it. It's great. You just plug in all the names, you download it from the web, you plug in the names, you have your ketubah. You know, I was at a wedding very recently, where the officiating rabbi forgot to bring a ketubah. Oops. So the caterer comes in, rabbi told him, thank God you're here. We don't have a ketubah. So he went to his office. On the RCA, Rabbinic Council of America website, they have these forms for download. He downloaded them in PDF form, printed them out, and that was the ketubah. What would we do without the internet?
Yeah, right.
Is that amazing?
Bride, you're usually allowed to get the bride.
Not this one. There you go. Because he said, the rabbi often said, nowadays they do it, but very often the rabbi will say, that's part of my job, to bring the documents you need. You know, you poor couple, they have to worry about the flowers and the colors of the napkins. They don't have to worry about everything.
Oh,
yeah. So the ketubah can be written for anything, but the get has to be written for its own sake. Vav, the shaloyeh mechusa ma'ase achakivata, has to be given over. Ela nitinato la bilvad. It must be given literally from him to her or through an agent. Has anybody ever witnessed a divorce proceeding? Anybody? Yeah? Right, it is given from him to put in her hands. We're absolutely meticulous about all of these things, extremely meticulous. Okay? Vishineula, it has to be given to her. It must be given to her before witnesses. It has to be given to her as a bill of divorce. Specifically, it must be given to her from the husband or his agent. And she just knows that's not a simple thing, because very often we send it in the mail. So if you're sending it, it has to have proper signs and the proper signatures. Has to be meticulously examined, and then the agent has to be established, and the agent has to transfer the divorce. Once, I was growing up, I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, and the rabbi of our high school was the rabbi of the shul, Rabbi Einemer, who I'd love to bring here to speak. Mm-hmm. And Rabbi Einemer was the rabbi of the community, and we were actually in 11th and 12th grade, we were learning Gittin. And so Rabbi Einemer very often would have people come to the school so that he would do a get. So he would have us sit in and, you know, cause, and watch the get and serve as witnesses. Sometimes we served as the Beis Din. One time I remember we went out to Potomac, Maryland. We drove out to some woman's house, like in the middle of, I don't know, Bethesda or somewhere, to give her. It turns out the woman was pregnant already, but they had finally convinced the husband to give a divorce. She didn't care either. She didn't care. She didn't care and he didn't care. But the rabbis cared. So the rabbi, nobody paid them. Nobody paid us. We drove out to the middle of nowhere to go give this woman a divorce so that she would have a get. You know, these are the stories that they don't... how you know.
One of them is that all these procedures intended presumably for her protection, the wife was furiously angry.
About all of them?
Well, it was a case where her husband had refused her a gift for years and years.
Ah, that's exactly what we're talking about.
Then
yeah.
All of a sudden he decided he wanted one. And so, with all these procedures and her, as far as she was concerned, her marriage had been over for 10 years and she was furious about all these procedures about handing it to her and she just, get it over with.
Right, right. But they have to do it the way it's got to be done. You know, and it's very, very meticulous. Okay. Bet. How do we know? These 10 things are min ha-Torah, Torah-oriented. If you don't have these 10 things, if the get was printed on a computer or written for some other woman, and they say, oh, her name is Shara, that's good enough. They used the wrong get. She's not divorced. If she went out and got remarried to somebody else and had children, those children, God forbid, are mamzerim. This is really, really serious stuff. This is why Orthodoxy is, you know, very, very territorial when it comes to divorce. You don't acknowledge any other divorce proceedings because if it's not done exactly properly, you have terrible situations that come up. And unfortunately, we see it all the time. We see it all the time. Okay, but how do we know? Shemar, as it is written, Vahaya, and it will be, Lotim Tachain Deinav, if she does not find favor in his eyes, the Katav La Sefer Kritut, Venatam Biyadav, Shilchami Vitari, writes her this bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out. So, et cetera, et cetera. The Rambam goes through each one and explains from the verse how each one is compulsory. It must be. So now we skip to chapter 2, Halacha 20, on the left-hand side. Misha Hadin Noteng. Let's say there are certain situations. The guy develops a case of, I don't know, boils. He's got boils. Terrible thing. The doctors say it's incurable. He will have boils forever. He can no longer live with his wife. He's repulsive to look at. This poor woman, right? She says, I love my husband, but I can't, you know, I just got married 10 days ago. I never met him before, and, you know, I'm not going to stick this out for the rest of my life. And he says, I got her now. If this woman doesn't stay married to me, no one's going to be married to me. Sorry, I'm not going to give a divorce. So it could very well be that under that situation, the Beit Din will look at it and say, you know, you really have to give her a divorce. And he says, my dear rabbis, I love you, but it's never going to happen. So, the basis that if a person is no din notein, the halacha is shekofa notel garish et ishto, that he can be coerced to divorce his wife, velo lo ratzal legarish, that he doesn't want to. Beit din shel Yisrael, a Jewish beit din, b'chol makom u'b'chol zman, in any place, doesn't have to be in Israel, in Oak Park, Michigan, u'b'chol zman, 2006, makin oso atchiyom arotza ani. Oh, that's the fun part. Have you ever been in one of those? I'm making it up. We never did it. I'm just kidding. You beat him until he says, okay, I want to give a divorce.
I don't think
so. V'yichtov haget, v'hu get kosher. And he writes the get, they write the get, and it's kosher. V'chein, and furthermore, in b'ku goyim, if non-Jews beat him, v'amrlo, and they said, asei mash Yisrael omrim lecha, do what the Jewish rabbis tell you to do, V'lachatu oto Yisrael b'yad ha-goyim ad shi'garesh. Somehow the Jewish Beit Din had a good relationship with the local police sergeant. And we said to Sergeant O'Leary, walking the beat, this guy's giving us trouble. And he knew how to handle things. Again, harei zek kasher. It's kosher. But v'im ha-goyim me'atzmam ansuhu achikata. But if the non-Jews themselves coerced him until he wrote the get, since the halacha is that he has to write it himself, this is a get puzzle. Not good. The lamalot bitel gets there. Shaharehi onus bein biyad goyim, bein biyad Yisrael. How can this be kosher? How can this be a kosher get, the Rambam says? Because what's the difference if a non-Jew coerced him or a Jew coerced him? She'ein omim anus. We only say coerced. Ela l'misha nilchatz l'mititichak la'asod davar. You can only be coerced against your will, says the Rambam. Very deep philosophical idea. You can only be coerced against your will to do something that's not in the Torah. It's not a mitzvah. Kagon mishahuka ad shemachar o ad shenatan. Dennis likes my car. He says, Rabbi, I really want your car. I say, Dennis, my Geo 96 Prism is not for sale. I've got good memories. And he makes it quite clear that either I sell him the car or he will own the car one way or another. So is it a good sale? Sure it is. But you stole it from me. You're not allowed to do that. Okay, so now, same thing. In a get, he wants me to divorce my wife. Can he force me? Yes. Is that a good divorce? No. Because it's only considered onus, coercion, for something like selling a car or giving me my house. But let's say my evil inclination is telling me, don't do a mitzvah, don't bench. My yetzer is telling me, go sin. Right? My yetzer is telling me, don't divorce my wife. There's a mitzvah to get a divorce. It's a mitzvah to divorce your wife in the proper situation. I mean, that's what you, by the way, you have to tell, we tell this a couple sometimes. Sometimes you see a couple, like, you know, they tried to work it out, they tried, they're killing each other. It's terrible. The kids are getting destroyed.
Yeah,
sometimes you say to a couple, maybe you guys would be better off not together. You know, I mean, sometimes their relationship is destructive. It's a very interesting, it's difficult, but sometimes it's a mitzvah in the proper situation to divorce your wife, to give her a gift.
What about children? Is children considered a bad situation?
What?
Are children considered a bad
situation? Depends. I'm not going to give any answer. It depends on the situation. Okay. Every time has to be evaluated individually. Okay. And if you coerced him until he did what he was obligated, or until you hit him until he distanced himself, this is not considered coercing him. Elahu anas atmo. Rather, he coerced himself with his misguided judgment. Leviga, therefore, a guy who doesn't want to divorce his wife, since he really wants to be a Jew, he wants to do all the mitzvot, meaning deep down, if you ask a person, if you would take away his evil inclination, his materialism, and his spite, and his hate for his wife, and all the fights that they had, you'd say, you want to be a good person? Yeah, I really want to be a good person. That's what his desire really is. But for some reason, his yetzer hara, his evil inclination is telling him, don't give her a divorce. Mess her around. Take advantage of her. And since you beat him up, I said, tashash yitzro, all you're doing is, you're beating down his yetzer hara. I want to, Kvar gay race there, so no. Then that's considered, yes, he wants to. So the Rambam says it's a powerful idea. How can you force a husband to divorce his wife against his will? He says, I don't want to. And we're beating him. Do you want to? No. Do you want to? Okay. Do we want to? Yes. Because the situation is such a destructive situation that it's a mitzvah for you to give her a gift. So why are you saying no? Because you're a jerk. There's no mitzvah to be a jerk. It's an avera to be a jerk. So we're going to beat it out of you until you acknowledge that it's really the right thing to do. It's a pretty heavy comment to the Rambam, isn't it?
But there are some people who, that no matter what, will never acknowledge, right? You can beat them all day, right?
Only in the movies.
Is that one of the 613 mitzvahs?
To divorce your wife? Yes.
Oh, dear.
Yes, it is. It is. Divorce is a mitzvah in the appropriate situation. That's what the Torah said. Look at the halakha. It says, the Torah says, matzah ba'er
v'atavar. The same people who go out of their way to create the situation to send the mother bird away from their nest, do they want to go create the artificial situation to divorce their wife?
What do you mean? Don't start with me. You give me a hard time.
There's no such thing as annulment.
There is. But annulment, not really. Annulment is only possible under the situation where the marriage was established under false pretenses. Not false pretenses, I didn't know we would get into a fight. False pretenses, she didn't tell me that, I don't know, she had cancer.
Married before?
Married before? I'm not sure.
No,
oh,
you're a
Cohen. Oh, you're a Cohen. It was something, even that, I'm not sure. She didn't tell me she had cancer. Now, you don't think that would be an important piece of information?
Yes, but not good enough for a divorce.
Really?
you marry a person you agree to take on
for better or for worse?
You know.
Where does it say for better or for worse?
It sounds like life insurance previous.
Somewhere next to it.
No, where does it say for better or for worse? If a woman is misleading a man about her, let's say she can't have children. She knows it and she doesn't tell you. Because she knows. What? They're a young couple. She, unfortunately, God forbid, Lo Aleinu, she's diagnosed as a young child that she can't have children. It happens.
Yeah, it is directly.
And she knows that, it's very hard to find a shidduch like that. What young man is going to take a woman like that? So she doesn't say anything. So the night after, they wake up next morning and say, honey, I love you. I got to tell you something. That is false pretenses. You may not marry someone under false pretenses, but
if the situation is reversed, the same thing applies.
Oh, sure.
If he is sterile.
So there are circumstances. Steve Cohen told me once, physically, we'll call it in football terminology, physically unable to perform. So you can go back and say that it's what's called a mekach tos, meaning it was a marriage under false pretenses and unawares. So in that case, that's a possibility. But in the vast majority of cases, I knew, he knew her, she knew him. They liked each other for the first year. But after a while, it all went bad. Yeah.
When we say that you can beat him out of him because that's not a secret, is there anything where a person who, in general, he believes in the Torah?
Yes.
And so therefore, it really is. I mean, his intent is to observe the Torah, and this truly has to be his Yetzer Hara.
Right.
But a person doesn't believe in the Torah.
The spark of Nishama in everyone. We all have our souls deep down. I don't know. Now go back to page one for a second. So now we understand that second paragraph. The Beit Din, when it had power, there were for hundreds and hundreds of years until America. The community had a tremendous amount of power. Even asked Manny Middleman about the community in Switzerland, right? If you didn't pay into the communal till, they wouldn't bury you. Wouldn't bury you. There was no chesed shalom, there was no private burial plot. If you were a Jew, you had to be buried in the Jewish cemetery. You wanted to be buried in the Jewish cemetery, you pay your communal dues. And if you died, and you hadn't paid your dues, the Chevra Kedisha would say to your family, pay. And they would. You know, not indigent people, but you know, people who just refused. They didn't want to. Community was extremely strong. You also have to remember that, especially Europe, European countries, even today, are religious countries, right? The state of England, the country of England, has an official church. It has a chief rabbi. Why does it have a chief rabbi? Because it acknowledges religion in the framework of the country. So now, by the way, in England, they don't have that much power anymore. But going back 100 years, 200 years, 500 years, the community had the power to influence itself, to police itself, to find itself, to take care of itself. So, if the husband didn't want to give his wife a divorce, you lived in Frankfurt, and you didn't give your wife a divorce, so all the Jews of Frankfurt would shun you. Nobody would sell you meat. You wouldn't get your seat in shul. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? That's communal power.
Is that not the way it's supposed to be today?
Sure.
But nobody does it, right?
Rabbi Schmalter announces in Young Israel of Oak Park that Joe Schwartz, you know, and refuses to give his wife a divorce, he will not be allowed to have aliyos in shul, and he is not welcome as a member of our shul until he gives his wife a divorce. What does Joe Schwartz do? What?
Finds another shul.
Next door! You know, this is... for, yeah,
right. True.
I've gotten sure.
Oh, okay.
I do. Sure. I do. You do that. An umbrella policy, yeah, as a clergy. So you go back to page one, a second paragraph on the bottom. Of course, the situation in the United States at this time is different. Here, because of the principle of separation of church and state, a bacon has no legal power to implement its decisions. In this sense, American Jews are weaker than their counterparts who lived in Babylonia or medieval Europe. In the United States, as in other places in exile, a husband can flout the demands of the Beit Din and simply refuse to give his wife a get. This has created a situation where a husband could blackmail his wife by demanding exorbitant sums of money or custody of their children before giving his wife a get, even when the Beit Din believes the get should be issued. So it's a uniquely American problem, Western problem. And it is a function of the breakdown of our communal institutions. absolutely a function of the breakdown of our community. That if we had a cohesive and coherent community, which Detroit really should, if you think about it, we could. If we had a cohesive community, if the guy can't buy meat, go to One Stop. I guess he'd go to Myers and buy meat. If the guy, if One Stop won't stand up, One Stop and food. No, doesn't happen in Israel. You can't force them in Israel either. The divorce courts, the religious courts have the power of divorce, but they can't coerce it. They don't. Although, I think in Israel they can jail them. If a guy refuses to give a get.
Well, there are a few states here with the judge can order that he follow the religious decree.
Now we get into thorny issues. Because now we know that a Beit Din, a Jewish court, can initiate, can coerce a get, but a non-Jewish court cannot coerce a get.
They can force him
to obey the...
Why? Why would they?
Because there are certain places we were politically forceful enough to get them put into law.
Such as?
New York State.
Right, New York had a get law.
Right.
But in 1982, New York... Excellent question. In 1982, the state legislature of New York passed the famous New York Get Law, which basically said that if there was a pending divorce in civil court, that the parties, the court could force the parties to go and, that's the best of my understanding, I know there's a lot of literature on this. Unfortunately, they say in 1992, the Get Law was expanded to such a degree, it was expanded and broadened to such a degree, where many rabbis began to question it and felt that it was so broad and gave the judge so much power that it transformed the law into coercion by a non-Jewish court. Then you're walking this very fine line. How can you have a civil case where the judge says, you've got to get a get? I don't want to get a get. No, you have to get a get, otherwise I'm not going to adjudicate your case. Well, is that coercion by a non-Jewish court?
Mm-hmm.
It can be. It very much can be. And that's why rabbis always shied away from doing these things. Now, there's a tshuva that I'm just going to show you the second half of from Moshe Feinstein. Moshe thought, you know, somebody asked him from Australia, and Moshe thought it was a good idea. It could be done if he did it in a very careful way. But that's the thing about secular law. How much, you know, we have lobbying power. We have the ability to ask for certain things. But A, it could be struck down. And B, you only have so much power in writing of the statute. The statute could be written in a way that comes out not like you like it, and then you're in big trouble, which happens a lot. Okay, so I want to turn to page 5. Now we come to the idea of our prenuptial agreement. This is from this book called Gray Matter by Rabbi Chaim Jachter. He's a really, really brilliant rabbi man in New York. Brilliant man. Beautiful, beautiful book. It's Gray Matter. Prenuptial agreements are fast becoming increasingly common at Orthodox weddings. This chapter addresses the prenuptial agreement formulated by Rabbi Mordechai Willig in cooperation with two Israeli authorities of Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg and Ramchaim Zimbalist. The need for halakhically valid prenuptial agreements is well documented. Often a spouse withholds a get as leverage in seeking money or child custody, or simply to inflict pain on an estranged partner. As a member of the Beit Din of Elizabeth since 1993, this author has witnessed many situations in which both women and men have suffered at the hands of recalcitrant spouses. Twice, a recalcitrant husband agreed to give a get only because he had signed a proper prenuptial agreement. Other rabbis and laymen report similar experiences. The problem of coercion. Formulating a halakhically sound agreement is far from simple. One cannot simply sign an agreement to give or receive a get in the case of a civil divorce. Meaning, you can't just write a prenup saying, I promise that if we get a civil divorce, I'll give you a get. Such an agreement is not halakhically valid because it is a kinyan dvarim, a commitment merely to perform an action and lacks any monetary consideration. Furthermore, a husband must give his get without coercion. If a man is wrongly coerced to give his wife a get, the get is not valid and the couple remains married. That we saw. Accordingly, a rabbinical court may not coerce a husband to give his wife a get even if he promised to do so before their marriage. I mean, there has to be grounds for divorce. They can't just say, well, we got a civil divorce. So it has to be halakhically legitimate. In addition, Rabbi Gershon insisted that a wife's consent is necessary in a get proceeding. In fact, Rabbi Akiva Eger cites the opinion of the Maharam of Minsk that, following Rabbi Gershon's enactment, a woman who is coerced to accept a get is not divorced. Therefore, a prenuptial agreement must be formulated in a way that does not inappropriately coerce either party to participate in the get procedure. So basically, there's no way to write beforehand, if we ever get divorced, I promise I'll give you a get. Because the bottom line is, either he's being forced to give it to her because of that agreement. So the judge in the civil court is going to say, I see this agreement, and I'm not going to allow you to go forward in this civil court because you have to kick to this agreement. So now who's forcing him to give her the get? In that case, that would be a civil judge. That's a non-valid get. The problem of monetary penalty. One possible formulation obligates whichever party refuses to take part in the get ceremony to pay a set sum of money to the agreed spouse on a daily basis. If I refuse to give you a get, I'll pay you $50 a day. Penalty. It's close. Such an agreement goes beyond a mere kinyan dvarim, as it includes a monetary commitment. Nevertheless, this agreement remains halakhically questionable because it may constitute improper coercion to participate in a get. Nearly all authorities consider financial pressure to be coercion and only to permit its use when halakha permits coercion. Okay, so it's controversial. I don't want to read the whole thing because I'm running out of time. Binding arbitration agreement. Okay? Despite, let's get down to the bottom of that page. Despite potential pitfalls, at least two ways of constructing a halakhically acceptable prenuptial agreement do exist. The first is a binding arbitration agreement in which husband and wife bind themselves to the jurisdiction of a particular beit din. This agreement requires a recalcitrant party to obey the rulings of a chosen beit din, and the secular court would presumably enforce the beit din's rulings. So all you do is write, if we ever get into a disagreement about divorce, we will arbitrate our dispute in beit din. And the only problem is, very often, women don't want to do it in beit din because financially it's in her interest to go to secular court. Another issue. This agreement is halakhically acceptable because it does not coerce either side to give or receive a get. The couple does not agree to participate in a get ceremony. Rather, they merely agree to obey the ruling of a particular beit din. Rabbi David Bleich, who is a well-known rabbi in New York, drafted an example of such an agreement. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein finds no halakhic problem with this type of document. This agreement empowers a beit din by making it likely that a civil court will enforce its ruling. For example, if a beit din rules that a husband must give a get, the wife may petition the court to force him to honor the arbitrary agreement that he signed. This coercion is halakhically acceptable as the civil court merely enforces the ruling of a beit din, and the beit din may sometimes coerce a man to give a get. Remember, we said that case, if you construct it that way, then all the civil court is doing is enforcing the beit din, which they agreed to go to in the first place. It's not the court forcing the get. But now we come to the one that we normally do. Rabbis Goldberg, Willig, and Zimbalist added a financial agreement to supplement the binding arbitration agreement. It is based on an agreement formulated by the famed Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa to provide financial motivation for giving a get, but it is a matter that does not constitute coercion. The Torah, husband waives his halachic rights to his wife's earnings, Ma'asi Adayim, while maintaining his obligation to support her. Thus, the man is thus motivated to give a get in order to release himself from his financial obligation to the estranged wife. So what it basically means is, I write the following. If we separate and initiate divorce proceedings in civil court, I have to support you halachically. So I will pay you $150 a day financial support until such time as I give you a get. Now, does the husband have to give his wife a get?
No.
He
just keeps
giving her money.
Giving her money. As long as he supports you.
Right. As long as he wants to support her, and as long as he wants to pay that money, he's welcome to do so and not give a get. And this is part of his obligation. The man is thus motivated to give a get in order to release himself from his financial obligation to his estranged wife. This is not coercion because the husband's financial obligations are a result of the marriage and are not a punishment for withholding the get. Therefore, he gives a get out of dissatisfaction with his marriage and not only because of outside coercion. Concerns of invalidating a get only arise when a financial penalty is directly linked to the get. Based on Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa's idea, the three contemporary rabbis devised a prenuptial agreement for use today. The husband agrees to pay $100 per day to support his wife in case they do not maintain domestic residence. This obligation remains in effect for the duration of the halachic marriage. In addition, the husband waives his right to the ma'aseh yildayim of his wife, meaning he waives his right to getting all the money that she gets. So she gets it directly. This document carefully avoids linking the husband's support obligation to his giving of a get. And then it goes on. So this is, I just want to show you, this is the prenuptial agreement, the Beit Din of America prenuptial agreement. It starts with a binding arbitration agreement between husband and wife, and you just kind of fill it out. It comes with instructions. Okay? And then it says, one second, the parties agree to appear in the Beit Din of America as the men of the other party. Okay? And the husband acknowledges that he recites and accepts the following. I hereby now obligate myself to support my wife to be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reason at the rate of $150 per day. You have our calculations. In lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, even if she has another source of income or earnings. Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights on my wife's earnings for the period that she's entitled to the above sum, and I acknowledge that I shall begin to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. I acknowledge that I have effected the above law by means of a kinyan, a transaction, and an esteemed beit din as prescribed by Jewish law. And they sign it. You can even get it notarized. And they send it off to the Beit Din of America, and they should never use it ever again. Now, just I will tell you that one of the problems is if the woman initiates, says, my dear, beloved Chassan, I love you dearly, but we should really get a prenup. So what does that say?
Scared she's going to get a divorce.
Yeah, well, you don't trust me? You think I'm a monster? You think I'm a monster?
Well, that's great. This is civil
prenup. Right. Civil prenups are really tricky, which is why, what's his face, didn't get a prenup, and now he's going to owe his former wife $1.2 billion. And, oh, I love you forever. I'm never worried. And, yeah, okay, fine. But in our weddings, we really do, you know, in civil marriage today, I'm not sure they really think they're going to be married forever.
Here in America.
In America, one doesn't get that sense. One gets the sense that I'm committing myself to you as long as I enjoy it, as long as it's good for me. So then we'll get divorced and we'll both move on. So, yeah, you need a prenup. But in Jewish life, you're hopefully going to be married to the person for the rest of your life. So how do you solve the problem of not creating that tension between the husband and the wife, the chassan and the kala? It's just quite simple.
The rabbi
insists on it. If I say to the couple, I'd love to marry you, but I won't do it without the prenup. Right? Then it's, you know.
It's out of their hands.
It's out of their hands. Great.
It's fine. One
right. Correct. And that is the great solution to the problem. I don't want it. You don't want it. The rabbi wants it. And then some people say, fine, rabbi, we'll find it. No problem.
Is there ever a case where the guy refuses to pay the money?
No, he can't because the money, this is a prenup, this is a Beit Din, an arbitration agreement. This is a contract, an American law contract.
Okay.
If she goes to, she can go to court and say to a civil court, he owes me $150 a day.
Garnish his wages.
They will garnish his wages. They will. I mean, you know, because okay. You get it notarized by notary public in the state of Michigan if you want to. And there's no way around that. So now, does he have to give her again? No. Does he have to pay money?
Yes,
he does. And Rabbi Jackson writes that this is a solution to the problem. The biggest problem is most rabbis don't use it. I mean, all rabbis from YU that I know would do it because we have, you know, Verli was a rabbi of mine. He's a very well-respected person. But it's really in more modern circles where this is accepted. Whereas in more yeshivish or Haredi circles, they don't do it. I've never heard of this being done. And I'm not entirely sure. I'll be honest with you. I don't know why.
So
I'm not sure. Maybe there's a halakhic reluctance. I don't really know what the halakhic reluctance is, being that this is accepted by these rabbis. But in the more Haredi community, it's not accepted to do this. And it's a problem. So it's only a solution for the couples that are more modern couples that are going to more modern Orthodox rabbis.
The modern rabbis use
that? Oh, all the time. 100%. Even in my Madrich, in the RCM Madrich, the text of this appears and how to fill it out. And it's very straightforward and no problem. But if you don't have one, it's an added level of protection for a young woman. Nobody ever wants to think about, God forbid, what should happen should things go bad. It shouldn't happen. They should sign this document and never use it and never look at it ever again.
Like fire insurance.
Right. But in the one or two cases where it came in handy, it's a big deal. And if we can avoid the problem of Aguna, we have an obligation to make sure that we try. All right, have a good week.